Hey folks, this is Kevin. On this very special episode of Risk, live from Caveat 2, you'll hear Heather Farley.
I knew what I had to do. I had to get here because Bono and I were to be wed on the top of the Empire State Building.
That and so much more, because this whole episode will be a celebration of what a glorious night we had at Caveat in New York last Thursday. We want you to hear how alive, how heartfelt, how connected that room feels. When we hung out with the audience afterward, they couldn't stop talking about how dearly they love the show and how hopeful they are that we find a way to make it through this existential financial crisis we're in. We're about 10% to our fundraising goal now, so keep sending that love and that financial support at patreon.com/risk or at paypal.me/riskshow. Another thing we had so much fun talking about with fans after the show are the new events we're debuting this summer, where the storytelling that happens comes from you, the attendees. We're calling these interactive social events Risk Presents What's Your Story, where myself and other producers of Risk are your hosts, and we help you meet and share stories and more with each other. So stay tuned. What's Your Story is coming, as is our next LA Risk show at our new home there, the Lyric Hyperion, on July 18th at 7:30 p.m. Remember, we're now at the Lyric Hyperion on July 18th in LA, and tickets are at risk-show.com/live.
We'll be right back.
At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today. Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
Now, I should warn you that the second story on this episode by David Drake includes animal death in it, but from natural causes. And eventually, we'll run all five stories from last Thursday on the podcast, but today, we'll be hearing three of them. So, without further ado, now here's the show. Whoa, whoa, whoa! you. What a beautiful audience. Big, big, big crowd here tonight. Oh, my God. Thank you so much for coming. Risk is the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. Some of the stories are kinky. Some of the stories are scary. Some are beautiful, tear-jerking. Some are sad. Anyway, we are going to have an outrageously wild emotional ride tonight. I call it the emotional nudist camp that is Risk. But I want to start with an extraordinary story. And she came here from the Berkshires in Massachusetts. She's a first-time storyteller, and we always say show a ton of love to our first-timers because they really are taking a risk. She'd like me to say, Heather has been ready for you. Are you ready for her? Please welcome to the stage Heather Farley.
Okay. By the fall of 2014, I knew my second marriage was over. The fighting had become vicious, and by the end, fighting was all there was left. So when one night after a particularly explosive incident, I told him to get out and take his filthy cat too, he did. Also taking our one shared car, but I was pretty content with the way that wrapped, so that was that. We had left my home of 15 years in Brooklyn, and it was really an Irish exit. We'd gone back to our mutual home county of the Berkshires. Even though I was back home, I hadn't really interacted with any of my old friends. I hadn't made any new ones. He was all I had, and he was gone, and I knew there would be things to be sorted out. I'd have to find a new place to live. I'd have to get a car. I'd have to get a job. But that would all happen in time. I was first going to just let the dust settle and enjoy this apartment that felt like Shangri-La compared to the basement in Williamsburg. What I loved best about this place, I mean, besides the fact that it was pretty nice, was that the downtown where it was located was a ghost town at night. So if I wanted to crank my tunes, and music was really always such a safe space for me in a difficult time, I could, and I did. So I just kind of got lost in the sound and figured, you know, come what may, I'd handle it. When a U2 album was released that September to iTunes, unbidden, and magically showed up in my phone, I couldn't remember buying it. I was broke. And I'd never been a mega fan, but I was the right demographic, and I was like, okay, new album, I'll get behind this, not realizing that this was the most reviled, you know, kind of musical release ever. But I was about it, so I started listening to it over and over and over again. And I was always one to parse the lyrics of songs. You know, they were always all about me and what I was experiencing at any given time. On that album, it was the track Every Breaking Wave. The lyric in particular, baby, every dog on the street knows that we're in love with defeat. Are we ready to be swept off our feet and stop chasing every breaking wave? And I thought I'd been swept off my feet the first time I got married. The second time I got married, I was wrong. So one Sunday night, it's around midnight, I learn that U2 is in the city, New York City, promoting this album. I knew what I had to do. I had to get here because Bono and I were to be wed on the top of the Empire State Building. The fact that I'd been diagnosed with bipolar earlier that year and had stopped taking my medication earlier that summer was neither here nor there. So I threw on my pristine white trench coat. It was the closest I had to marital attire. And I remember my ex had taken the car, but I figured I would just walk out of the house. First one I saw, I'd hop in, I'd get behind the wheel, I would head to New York City, nuptials, etc. So I did. The fact that there was a car parked directly next to my building with the keys in the ignition felt like a sign. So I got in the car and I turned the key and began to drive. I turned up the radio. Bruce Springsteen was on. He was not my paramour, but he would do in a pinch. And the journey had begun. I was pulled over 15 minutes later. I probably was not driving as well as I could have under other circumstances. I was very excited. I had a place to go. So I knew enough to remember that this car did not belong to me. I was closely connected to that fact of life. But I thought maybe I could just eyelash my way out of it. I could flirt my way through this. And I there wasn't much of a plan, but I rolled down my window. Officer approaches. I notice his name is embroidered on his uniform. And I say, "Officer, may I see your badge?" Killing time. And he points to this embroidered name. And I said, "That's not what I asked for. I wanted to see like a metal badge like I'd grown up seeing on Chips or so. I don't know what I had in mind." And it occurs to me that maybe he's not a real police officer. And maybe I'm in danger. So I roll the window back up and I gun it. Starting a 50-mile, 70-mile-per-hour high-speed chase down Route 7 of Berkshire County, a very sleepy part of the world. Every time I passed into a new township, a couplet of cruisers joined the parade I'd begun, blue and whites flashing, and I was not stopping for anything. I wasn't going in the right direction of New York anymore. I don't know where I was going, what I thought I was doing, but I wasn't stopping until the sheet of spikes they'd laid down in the road stopped the chase for me. So, at that point, I kind of had surrendered to the reality of the fact that, you know, I wasn't going to get any farther, at least not immediately. Officer approaches, short exchange. What I remember is that the rest of the battalion that had been following us were all laughing. And I didn't see what was funny at all. So they cuffed me and they put me in the back of the cruiser. I was very slender then. I wasn't taking great care of myself. And I somehow managed to pull a Houdini, wriggle out of my cuffs, toss them in the front seat, through the divide, and say, "You're gonna have to try harder than that." I mean, I was... So I spent a night in jail and was taken to the local hospital where I was put on a cocktail of medication that would change my life forever, for better, because I never knew how sick I was. Remember, though, we have the matter of Grand Theft Auto to deal with. So any true crime fan knows that less than 1% of people plead insanity. Defendants in the U.S. plead insanity. Of that 1%, less than 25 are successful. I sat with my lawyer. We decided we'd give it a shot. I met with a forensic psychiatrist. I'm a big Law and Order fan. This was exciting to me at the time. I was still not quite back grounded yet. I remember at the end of the interview asking him, I said, "So do you think I was insane? You know, do you think this is gonna work?" And he looked at me and nodded and smiled and said, "Yes." So I went to court, and the judge, I stood by my lawyer, the judge kind of shuffles through the papers pursuant to my case, looks at my lawyer, looks at me. I don't remember exactly what he said, but my lawyer smiled at me, put his hand on my back, showed me out of the courtroom, and I was free. No fines, no community service, no record, No jail time, no shame. People have subsequently asked me, psychiatric professionals, counselors, whatnot, if I remember what happened that night. And I guess it's not atypical for someone experiencing a psychotic break to not remember any of it. But I remember all of it. The stars in the sky, the feeling of excitement, the laughter. And that is a blessing and a curse.
Heather Farley, everyone! Holy cow! For a first-time storyteller, that is something else. Wouldn't it be wild if it turned out that, like, it's a totally different story and has nothing to do with all of that, but Heather is currently betrothed to Bono? We'll have to have her back for that one because it takes a lot more explaining.
We'll be right back.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Hey, I'm Brett Podolsky, co-founder of The Farmer's Dog. We make fresh food for dogs. We started the company when we saw what a huge difference it made in my own dog, Jada, when she stopped eating ultra-processed kibble and started eating fresh, whole food. The Farmer's Dog food isn't fancy. It's just real food delivered to your door in pre-portioned packs. It's better for them. And easier for you.
Get 50% off your first box at thefarmersdog.com/podcast. That's thefarmersdog.com/podcast.
We're back.
Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for two more incredible, emotional, beautiful stories to tell you a new asshole?
We've gotten full metal. It's so exciting. All right, so please welcome back to the stage your friend and mine, Kevin Allison, in the second half of Russ!
Hello, 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 hello! Oh my gosh, that was so wild because I was talking to someone during the intermission who has told a story on the show before, also about bipolar, and Bono was also in that story, chasing him around Dublin with the CIA. It's just interesting how he pops up. He's a lightning rod, that Bono. But Heather, we were talking backstage, and she was talking about, like, how she would only gradually start coming out to people in her life in tiny little pieces about the whole of that story, and that tonight really felt like a full coming out. And I love when people feel like doing the show is kind of therapeutic in a way. Like, a lot of people have real breakthroughs when they come and share stories on the show. Yeah. And that's true for listeners, too, and that's true for us in the staff, too. I'm so excited to bring our next storyteller up to the show. I think this is his third time, and he has been hilarious each time he's been on the show. He's been on Comedy Central, HBO, and Fox. He is the producer of the show Comedians You Should Know, NYC. Please welcome to the stage, David Drake!
I wrote this story 10 years ago, and I stopped telling it because it didn't really have an ending. I just kind of fumbled around, and it's kind of bleak, and people just kind of be sad, and then I'd go. And that's no way to have a good time, so I stopped telling it. But then recently, something happened when my daughter was born, and I was like, ooh, maybe this could be the ending. So we're going to try that out tonight. And hey, if it fails, it'll just be a bad podcast. You know? What are you going to do? But we're going to give it a shot. All right. This is the story about the time I gave a C-section to a cat. This is a great story because I have a degree in creative writing. So already, we've established stakes. I don't know what I'm doing. The short setup is after college, me and my friend Mike wanted to do some community work, but we don't know anything about how to do that or where to start. Luckily, we had a friend, Claire, who we went to high school with, and she was trying to set up a program in Thailand that works with schools, raises money for schools, paints libraries, does that kind of thing. And she's like, do you guys want to be a part of this program? And me and Mike were like, yes, of course, that sounds amazing. So we fly into Bangkok, and we're in Bangkok for 4 days. And then Claire comes in to meet us, and something happened within those 4 days where she lands and she's like, hey, the program kind of fell through, and we can't work with schools anymore, but it's okay. I found this guy on this island. He works on this vet clinic. They have a big stray cat and dog population on the island, and they just need a lot of help neutering and spaying all of the cats and dogs, which is so different than working with children. I don't even know if I agree with that. Spaying. I've never met a dog I didn't love right away. Have as many dogs as you want. If anything, there's so many people I would neuter before a dog. My friend Joe, he's 38, he eats food all gross, and he's always hooking up with these 20-somethings in bars, and then he tells me about it, and I get all horny, and I bring all this dark, horny energy back to my family and my daughter. Neuter Joe and Joe. Million people. My parents, all right, listen. My parents have been in love and attracted to each other and together for 30 years. And sometimes they'll be in my apartment and I'll just catch them look at each other and they're just staring into each other's eyes. And I'm like, get out of my apartment. Gross. I walked on my parents 4 times. 3 of those were when I was a child, which is fine. Because when you're a kid and you walk into your parents, you don't even really see... Like, you see shapes, and your brain's like, don't even worry about this. And then you kind of black out, and you live your life. But then the 4th time was this last summer. Yeah. Where I was visiting my mom and dad, and I was making a sandwich in the kitchen, and then I heard my mother scream from upstairs. And I was like, oh no, mom's in trouble. And then I ran. I ran to I skipped stairs to get there. I burst into my mother's room and she was fine. She didn't need my help at all. In fact, that would be discouraged in my family. So, well, we're in Thailand, so I guess we'll be vets. So we go to this island. It's an 8-hour bus ride where the seats, they reclined all the way back, which, come on, people don't deserve power like that. I was sitting on an 8-hour bus ride and then an old woman's face entered my... I was like, this country is fucked. Like, if this happened on planes, the world would be on fire. This is not allowed. 8-hour bus, 4-hour boat, and now I'm a vet. And there was no process. They're just like, here you go. And so I started with basic checks on animals, which I hate doing. You have to take their temperature. You stick a thermometer in a dog's ass, which I don't know if you've ever tried to suck the joy out of a dog. That's a pretty nice, easy way to do it. Dogs would come in all happy and dog, and then I would stick a thermometer in their ass, and I actually watched a dog question its worldview for the first time. Where it's like, hey, I'm a dog. And I stuck it in. And he's like, I never knew my father. I get the ball. I bring it back. What's the point? Yeah. But like all nightmares, you do it long enough, it becomes normal. So about a month in, I'm a veterinarian in Thailand. And this woman, she comes in and she brings in her hot cat. It's like... This guy was a hard eight. Awesome body. Okay. Listen, this isn't nothing weird about this. You see enough ugly cats, you start to appreciate a good whatever. Brings in her hot cat. She puts it on the desk and she's like, ah, she speaks Thai. I'd never learned Thai. So that's that to me. I was like, oh, something's wrong with the cat. She's like, ah. I was like, I see. The cat's pregnant. Got to get the kids out. We can do it. So I bring the cat back to the veterinarian. And he opens up the cat, and I see the inside of a cat for the first time, and it's purple throbbing tubes. And I'm like, oh man, life is a nightmare. Wow. We're all tubes. He cuts open one of the tubes, and he pulls out 4 beautiful baby kittens. And he washes those off, and he hands them to me. And then he sews up the cat, and then he's like, hey, you just rub these all over the cat. Which is, I guess, something you have to do when you give a C-section to a cat, because C-sections aren't natural to cats. They don't give them to each other. So, like, if they don't see themselves give birth, they don't believe that these are its children. So what you have to do is you have to trick the cat into believing that these are its kids. And the way to do that is you have to rub the kittens all over the cat so that they have the same vibe or whatever. I'm not a vet. So, I'm rubbing cats on a cat for like a long time. There was no specific time given to me. I'm just rubbing. It looked like I was racing a cat with other cats. I'm just rubbing them. Like, is this enough time? I guess. And then I put the cats next to the cat so that they're the first thing that she sees when she wakes up. And then Papa's going to lunch, because you got to eat every day or else you get a headache and you get angry at your friends. So me and Claire, we go to lunch and we have a really nice time. And then we come back and Snowball, that's the name of the cat, she has eaten 2 of the kittens. So we take the 2 remaining kittens away. We have them away from Snowball and we're like, what do we do? Because they do need to eventually be with Snowball because that's where they get their nourishment. That's how they live. So we have to think of a way to introduce them to Snowball and get her to take them in as her children and recognize them as her children. And the way you do that is you put a kitten in and you hope. Please, God, let this be the kitten that you just think is yours. So we did that. We put a kitten in and Snowball started to lick it, which is confusing because it's like, that's cat behavior, but that's also ice cream behavior. Is this good? Is this a food? But sure enough, Snowball did kill and eat them all. So yeah, that's where the story used to end. You can kind of imagine how people would be a little upset. So that was the end of the story. And then I came back to America and I wrote the story and I left people unsatisfied for a decade. But then something happened during the birth of my daughter, which changed it all. My wife was in labor. We're in the hospital and in walks the nurse's assistant. And the nurse's assistant is Claire, the woman who brought me to Thailand. And I have not seen Claire in 12 years. In fact, one of the last times I saw Claire was when we were delivering these lunch cats together or whatever. I was like, holy God, it's Claire. And she brought fears out of me that I don't think most expectant fathers have. Like, oh no, will my wife eat the baby? They put the baby on my wife and I was like, you gotta really rub it in there because she hasn't eaten in like a month or whatever, however long you gotta prep for this. But the most shameful thought I have, the thought I'm most embarrassed of, is when Claire handed me my daughter, my sweet, darling baby girl, for the first time. And I looked into her deep blue eyes for the very first time. My first thought was, oh, finally, I have an end to this bit. Thank you.
David Drake, everyone!
Oh my goodness. The lunch cats. Oh my gosh. So listen, folks, this has been such a thrilling evening. We have one more story for you tonight, but I want to let you know we will be back here on September 28th, so come on back and bring friends. Now, our final story of the show goes into more serious territory. This is really exciting because she saw Risk when it was in Philly several months ago and thought to herself, yeah, I really want to like do that show. And so she came up and here she is. She is a comedian in improv and sketch, but she is another first-timer for this kind of storytelling. So let's show her a lot of love. This is Yasmin Bedoun.
So I was 13 when my parents finally agreed to let me go to summer camp. And I grew up in New York City. So summer camp is like a centerpiece of American childhood, and this was about to be the best summer of my life. Like, it was going to be this movie montage, Mia Thermopolis moment, when I would just cast off all traces of my Arabness, like the unibrow and the mustache, and I would transform into the real me. Like, Yasmin 2.0, hotter, hornier, better than ever. It was gonna be like a white baptism. Like, I was going to submerge myself into this camp lake, a smarmy Middle Eastern girl, and emerge a beautiful white princess, friendship bracelets and all. So instead of summer camp, my family usually would spend our summers visiting our extended family in Beirut, Lebanon. And this is like a very post 9/11 childhood. So Beirut is low-key kind of scary to me at the time. Like, Islamophobia is in full swing in New York City, and here I am in a country filled with people named Muhammad. Like, I have an uncle named Osama. It's crazy when you grow up afraid of your own people. So typically, we'd spend our summers in my grandma's dusty Beirut living room, just like waiting for it to be over. And my siblings and I would spend our days around her TV, this like ancient TV set, scrolling through all 12 channels, just desperate in a way kids these days will never understand. Like, we'd find like a 1950s period drama, and it would be halfway through, and we would like crowd around that TV, our faces inches from the static, just soaking in the bliss of American entertainment. But okay, this summer is going to be different. My parents have agreed I can go to summer camp after our trip to Lebanon. Fine. So we're in Beirut, and I am sleeping in as late as I can every day, just like willing this part of the summer to be over as quickly as possible. When one day my dad wakes me up, and his face is looking at me softly, full of concern. And my dad and I are really close. But I'm trying to, like, put some space between us in a way that, like, preteens who think they're grown-ups do. But I'm mostly failing because I love my dad so much, it hurts. And my dad looks at me, and he says, Habibte, there's been an attack. Israel and Hezbollah are fighting. And a school in southern Lebanon was hit this morning, and 12 children died. And I'm sitting in bed looking up at him, thinking, like, okay, and? Like, why did he wake me up to tell me this? Like, I mean, don't get me wrong. It's sad. I'm not an asshole. But, like, southern Lebanon might as well be, like, Iraq to me. Like, where we are in Beirut, there is a Starbucks and an H&M. And, like, sometimes my mom will take me shopping at the Zara if there's a sale. Like, southern Lebanon is a different country. But he continues. He goes, Beanie. That's my childhood nickname. He goes, Beanie, the Israelis, they also hit the airport. So we can't fly out. And they've bombed all the roads leading out of the country. So we can't drive out either. It's too dangerous. And he goes, Beanie, we're going to be stuck here for a little while. And that's when the gravity of the situation dawns on me. I'm going to miss camp. The edges of my mouth curl downward the way that they do before I'm going to cry, like a big cry. And my dad, he starts to console me and be like, it's okay, Habibte. We're going to be okay. And I realize he thinks I'm crying for a much nobler reason than I am. Because, like, at this point, I'm really not too concerned about the whole, like, war situation. Like, everything in my 13 years of life to this point have shown me that I'm basically the main character of the world. And this is, like, before they chop off Ned Stark's head in season one. So, like, from my frame of reference, you cannot kill the main character in act one. It doesn't make sense for the story. But over the course of the next 2 weeks, I learn what war means. And pretty soon after that, I forget what camp is all about. Because every night now, there is a new attack. And every night, like, homes are being destroyed and neighborhoods are getting leveled. And, like, we're watching on TV as, like, buildings are coming down and, like, these skyscrapers, like, there's people inside of them. And this tiny country the size of Connecticut is being bombed to pieces and we're trapped inside. On the night with the heaviest bombing, I'm in bed next to my mom when we hear the explosions closer than ever before. And we realize they're hitting our neighborhood tonight. And my dad, like, flies into action. He's, like, pacing the room and calling people. And I'm in bed next to my mom. And my mom is, like, a no-nonsense kind of mom. Like, growing up, if we would, like, fall and scrape our knee, she'd be like, come on, get up, yalla, you're fine. Or if I'm, like, in a plane and there's turbulence, she would kind of, like, look at me and, like, roll her eyes lovingly and be like, don't be an idiot, you're fine. So this, like, tough-as-nails mom is sitting next to me in bed and she's sobbing. And she is, like, rocking herself back and forth, praying to Allah that he spares our building. Just like, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. And I'm lying next to her, completely frozen, but my mind is racing. And I'm wondering if our building is hit, will there be a moment when we know before the rubble of seven stories comes down on us, or will it just happen any second now and everything will go black? And I start thinking about my brothers, because they're not in Lebanon with us this summer. And I realize that if we die tonight, they're going to be all alone. And there's going to have to be, like, a moment tomorrow when someone's going to have to break the news to them to tell them that their family is gone. And they're going to miss us so much. And that's when I start praying too. But we make it through the night. Our building is spared and outside is smoke and, like, rubble. and my dad realizes we need to get the fuck out of Beirut. So we drive north 2 hours, and he checks us into this, like, bougie beach resort. And we are the only people there because, like, shocker, no one's trying to go on a vacation in Lebanon right now. So I have this whole place to myself, which is actually kind of awesome because there's this, like, enormous pool, and I have it to myself. And it doesn't take too long for me to make this hotel my, like, mental safe space. Like, there's pizza in the restaurant, and the room service makes, like, your towel into, like, the little swan thing. And I am like, this is where I belong. I will not leave this hotel no matter what. When one day my parents get this absurd idea, they come to me and they go, Beanie, wouldn't it be nice if we left the hotel and we went into town for dinner tonight? Wouldn't that be nice? No, absolutely not. This is my home. And you will have to drag me out kicking and screaming, which they do, because they're my parents. So we're walking to town, and I am pouting. I, like, have my arms crossed, and they're, like, strolling about, pretending this is, like, a nice family vacation. Like, what if we get ice cream after dinner? Won't that be nice? When we hear a plane overhead, and it's really, really loud. It's close. It's too close. And we all look up suddenly, trying to find it, and we're all making this mental calculation of, like, how close is it? Is it too late to take cover? What do we do? When we hear the explosion, and it's like this supersonic boom that just explodes the world into a million pieces. And when fear hits my body, my, like, legs go weak and my face goes slack. It's almost like a drug hitting me. And I can feel the terror explode in my heart and ripple out in this nausea throughout my body. And after the fear comes the panic. Everyone starts fleeing from the site of the explosion. And I see in front of us this woman and her child, and she's running and screaming at the top of her lungs. And this little boy is following her, and his cheeks are, like, streaked with tears, and he looks so scared and so confused up at his mom, not understanding what's happening to him. And this image of the woman and her son, it, like, etches itself into my brain. I, like, can still see it because I realize in that moment I've seen this before. Like, I don't know these people, but I've seen this tableau, this, like, freeze frame of Arabs running in fear, taking cover in nameless Arab cities before, in the newspaper and on TV and in magazines. I can almost see the headlines, another bombing in the Middle East. And I realize we're here now inside of the news story, but it's not a news story. And I realize it never was. It's always been real. So not too long after that, my dad realizes we need to get the fuck out of the country. And we take our chances on the road, this heavily bombed out road to Syria. And we make it to Syria. And from Syria, we can catch a flight to Dubai. And from Dubai, we fly home to New York. And a week later, I am sitting in a bunk at summer camp, a shell-shocked 13-year-old. And the other girls are gathered around me, and they're really nice. And they're like, what's your name, and where are you from, and how come you missed week one, and are you excited for Color War? And my brain is, like, puttering out these error messages. Because, like, when we were in Beirut, all I wanted was to get out. And now that we're out, I just, like, can't believe that everyone else isn't in it. Or watching this conflict unfold with bated breath, worried about these people. And I, like, want to shout at these girls. Like, there are people dying. Every day there is, like, rubble and dust and, like, children covered in blood. And in Beirut, there is probably a 13-year-old girl who is, like, embarrassed about her unibrow and was supposed to be having the best summer of her life. And if we're all the main characters, then she is too. And this isn't supposed to happen to her. This isn't supposed to happen to any of us. So since that summer, I've gone back to Beirut each year. And each time I went, I found myself a little more curious about this place where I apparently I'm from. And I found something new that I liked about it and then loved. Like, I found out that this tiny country, like the size of Connecticut, it has these like epic snow-capped mountains and these dramatic valleys where water just gushes out of limestone cliffs. And this beautiful seaside corniche where, like, children rollerblade and men smoke their erguile, like hookah pipes. And the people are exuberant with life and welcoming and kind and hilarious. And when I was 23, 10 years after that summer, I moved to Lebanon. And at 24, I met my husband there. And I love being Lebanese. And I love being Arab. And if I ever do have children, by God, I am going to drag them there every fucking summer to bask in the glory that is their homeland. Thank you. عاشق بقالي سنين ولا غيرك في بالي حبيبي يا نور العين يا ساكن خيالي عاشق بقالي سنين ولا غيرك في بالي
This is Risk. This is Amra Diab behind me now. This is a favorite of Yasmin's and a hugely popular hit from 1996. Yasmin was such a joy to be with that night. We're so thrilled that she pitched us and that we could get her up on stage in New York. And you can find her at Yasmin Beydoun on Instagram. You know, there's something to be said that the show is still so strong, even when we're struggling to stay alive right now. You know, we're certainly keeping things interesting. For example, before every Risk show in New York, JC, my business partner, my better half here, she tells the audience that they can't talk during stories, but they can feel free to fart. Well, folks, no one comes through quite like Risk fans do. Take a closer listen to this moment from when Heather Farley was on stage.
So I went to court. The judge kind of shuffles through the papers pursuant to my case, looks at my lawyer.
Now, where else on earth do you get valuable content like that? Listen, if you haven't heard, Risk is doing the biggest fundraising push we have ever done before this summer. We are extremely dangerously low on funds right now. With everyone on staff taking pay cuts while working much harder, our income streams will be more stable toward the end of the year. But first, we have to last to the end of the year. We're on thin ice, so if you feel the show does bring value to you, if you feel you'd miss it if it was gone, please chip in. We need all the help we can possibly get right now. There's so many perks to access at patreon.com/risk, like hundreds of hours of bonus stories, personal check-ins, behind-the-scenes conversations, ad-free versions of the episodes, video calls with me, storytelling training, and more. Again, that is all at patreon.com/risk. And if you want to make a one-time donation, that's at paypal.me/riskshow.
We have a brand new anecdote compilation over there at Patreon right now. It was edited by Roman Den Houdiker, and the stories are by Sage Rorda, Rob Putnam, and Aaron Marr.
And I finally said to him, I just have one question for you. How did you know my car was getting hit? And to that he responded, yeah, we got a call that a naked man was beating up a car in the parking lot.
So, Patreon people can hear that and so much more over there. And I want to give a shout out to all the folks giving $25 or more there per month, including Ann Wolf Anderson, Kelly Lyon, Sean Snyder, Haley Kepke, Wanda Bowser, Julian Yu, Elizabeth Nudek, Lauren Piera, Sharon Porter, and Michael Stolper. Thank you all so, so, so much. And anyone out there listening, please give what you can as well, even if it's just a little. And if you want to make a one-time donation, again, that's at paypal.me/riskshow. And if you want to contribute in some other way than those methods, just email me at kevin@risk-show.com.
We'll be right back.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
We're back.
Well, folks, I already told you, you're going to hear the other two stories from that same caveat show soon enough. Like next week, you'll hear my story in which I say,
get the mayonnaise!
However, that's next week. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk.
Same. A few people laughed. A few people cried. Most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. I suppose we all thought that one way or another.